All right, everyone, welcome to Medicine and Morals Lesson 4. This is a very, very important class, educational class, on some levels an exciting class. I think you'll all be very surprised at some of the things we're going to say today.
Heartbreaking.
Huh? Heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. Sure. Sensitive class. Hopefully you're going to learn some things today. So before we begin our topic of reproductive technologies and what Jewish law has to say about the various treatments that are out there, let's do a very quick review of last week's class, which is a completely different topic, but just kind of to just refresh our memory so that we might recall some facts. So take a look at the handout review questions. The first one is, according to halacha, Jewish law, can a terminally ill patient opt for a risky course of potentially life-saving treatment? Cite the earliest Jewish source for your answer. Who's got that? Again, terminally ill patient, and the life-saving treatment option is risky. Go or no go? Allowed or not allowed?
50%,
yes.
49%.
Ah, so okay, good. Now you're getting it. Yeah, answer is yes and no. Okay, good. What's the earliest source that we have in Judaism for the permissibility?
The anti-Semitic doctor?
No, that was the Talmud. What was the source that the Talmud quoted? The one before that?
The lepers.
The four lepers. The four lepers that were dying of starvation, and they said, we're going to the enemy. Whatever may come, we need to eat. That was the source that we had, the earliest source of that possibility or that permission, permissibility. The second question, how does halacha, Jewish law, define short-term life? And how do we define the degree of acceptable risk? So what is short-term life?
Well, 12 months.
That's the consensus. Some say if it's terminal, then it's even longer than 12 months. But the consensus was 12 months or less. The degree of acceptable risk was?
The source of that was just...
The source was trefa. The loss of trefa by an animal. If an animal is going to die within 12 months, it's not a kosher animal, or it's you cannot shecht it, or you cannot eat it as a kosher animal. Degree of acceptable, but yeah, it's not a clear source, but you're right, it's not a clear source that by human being that defines it. But most say that they're using that as somewhat of a framework. Degree of acceptable risk, you alluded to it before. 50?
50.
Or it could be less. We had actually three opinions. Some say it has to be a 50% chance. Some say it could even be a reasonable chance, less than 50%, as long as it's reasonable. Some say even a remote chance. There's permission to go ahead and roll the dice for potentially life-saving treatment. Now, the third and final question of the review was, or is, does Jewish law ever allow one to undergo experimental treatment? Treatment that's not only risky, but experimental. It's like, you don't even know that it works on human beings. The only thing that we know is that on mice or lab rat, whatever, it works there. We don't know if it works on human beings. We don't even know the degree of risk. What's it, 5%, 10%? Who knows? So are you allowed to at all? According to some, yes. According to those that say that you can even take a remote chance to save life, or to not say to preserve or to gain long-term life, then you can take experimental treatment. And many rabbanim, many poskim, many experts in Jewish law would give that permission to go ahead and undergo experimental treatment under the right circumstances. Okay. Good. That was the review. So again, today, this week, we are talking about the subject of new beginnings, the ethics of reproductive technology. What does halacha, what does Jewish law say about artificial insemination, IVF, in vitro fertilization? What does halacha say about ICSI? What does halacha say about lots and lots of technologies that are out there, that are available? What is the Jewish view on these options? Now, just to talk a little bit about the struggle to have children, there are studies, and Irena can help me with this. I saw a study that says up to 15% of couples are challenged with struggling to have children.
15%?
Up to 15, yeah. Is it more?
I don't remember exactly the data, but I think it's a little bit more. And
it's even more.
It's even more. And it's not, they are just not taking, and the reason why it's more is that they are just not taking married couples, but they are seeing
that people that are together.
The people that are having more of a problem with infertility is the group of people who's between 16 and 24.
Interesting. Interesting.
They're having higher rates of infertility.
That's something that, and by the way, Irena, let's speak about your what you do, because this is very relevant to today's topic.
So what I do is I work with families that, and with, you know, women, men, couples that are dealing, and this is part of what I do, right, what are dealing with infertility and also with sexually reproductive assistance. So I have them, maybe whether they're going into the treatments, and the treatments are, you know, how many treatments would you go for after you say, okay, this is it, and if you say this is it, what option do you go to? And there are many options. Although they don't feel like an option many times to the people that are involved, it just, you know, it's plan B. It's not like a, okay, you know, great. And
right.
So that's what you need to work on with the people, and they can do either egg donation or sperm donation or egg donation, sperm donation, surrogacy, adoption, choose life without parenting.
And we're going to actually speak about most, if not all, of these options today.
Are you a physician or more like a therapist?
I'm a therapist.
You're like almost
a doctor. And we're actually going to talk about this and the need from a Jewish perspective.
Yeah.
Yes, because what I want to say is, even though perhaps, and I don't know the historical numbers and figures about
it's one in four couples.
But I'm saying, I don't know historically if it's always been this high, if it's getting high. I don't know historically, but I will tell you that when you look through biblical literature, you find many stories of individuals, of couples, who were not able to have children. The stories are many, and throughout Torah, throughout Tanakh, the other books of the other parts of the body of Torah literature, you find stories. In fact, if you look at text number one, it's from the Medrash, the Psikta, the Rav Kahana. It says there are seven infertile women mentioned in the Bible. You see page 116. Seven infertile women mentioned in the Bible: Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah, the wife of Manoach, who was the mother of Samson, and Hannah, and Tzion. Who was Tzion? Who was Zion? It's a city. But it's referred to in the book of Isaiah as a barren woman who has no children, following the destruction, or prophesying about the destruction of the temple. So it's seven references to infertile women in Torah. One of them is actually a city, was not actually a person. But that's number seven. But it's interesting, Leah, we know that Leah had seven children, six boys and a girl, Dinah. So where was she infertile? She was infertile. The idea is that she was naturally not able to have children, and then through a blessing, through whatever it was, she was able to have children.
Does it say this somewhere?
It's a medrash. It's not in scripture itself. Torah. Scripture is clear on most of those. On Sarah, we know for sure. Rebecca, we know for sure. Rachel, we know for sure. The wife of Manoah, we know for sure. Hannah, we know for sure. And Tzion, again, is Jerusalem. But
what is that word that you used?
Hannah?
No.
Tzion? Zion. Same thing.
No.
Oh, which?
Leah. It's a what?
Oh, a midrash.
Oh, midrash. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a midrash. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. She did stop. That's true. Yes. Yeah, so it is secondary. Yes. That's right. She did. Leah did stop.
It said she had.
Yes. I'm sorry for missing this. That's what. She stopped. Atifsumi Ledis. She stopped. Thank you. She stopped. She had four, and then she was not able to have children. And then she was blessed with two more afterwards. Miraculous. So yes, thank you. I was wondering myself, and I figured there must be some sort of magic tradition that, but no, it is biblical. It is clear. She was not able to have children. And so she gave her handmaid,
right,
and then she gave the dudaim, and anyway, in honor of that, to her sister, she was able to have two more.
So what's actually the definition of infertility? So I would think of it as someone that can never have children, so...
Struggling, you know, seven infertile women, so the way the Medrash is saying of people, women that by natural means were not able to have children, through divine intervention or other sorts of intervention, they were able to have children. But the more broad way of understanding is these are women that struggled with infertility, with having children. And the most... Not the most... what we find in Torah is that when it describes the struggle... It describes the intensity of the struggle. Text. Let's read through some texts. 2a, 2b, and 2c. Here are three of the examples in Torah where it talks about these struggles, and it really emphasizes the emotional pain that's involved with the struggle. Stanley, will you please read text 2a? This is about Abraham.
After these incidents, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am your shield, your reward is exceedingly great." And Abram said, "O Lord God, what can you give me so long as I continue to be childless? Behold, you have given me no seed, and behold, one of my household will inherit me."
God says, "Don't worry, I'm going to give you a lot, I got your back." And Abram says, "My legacy." So we see the struggle. We see the intensity of his pain. Continue reading text 2b. I'm going to have you read all of the within the two family.
And Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit, and I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Out of the abundance of my complaint and my vexation have I spoken until now."
So this is Hannah, who's the mother of Samuel, the prophet Samuel, Shmuel Hanavi, and she also is childless, and she goes to the Mishkan, to the tabernacle, the home for God that was then in Shiloh. It wasn't in Jerusalem. This is before the temple was built, and she's davening, she's praying, and she's praying with intense emotion. So much so that the high priest, whose name was Eli, he had never seen somebody pray with such intensity as he saw her pray with. So he says to her, "Excuse me, do you happen to be intoxicated?" No, that's what he says.
She was moving her lips.
She was moving her lips, and the sound wasn't coming out. But even the intensity, and she was crying, and her lips were moving, and he couldn't hear any sounds. So it was a very unusual type of prayer all around. So he says actually the quote, "Remove your drunkenness from upon God's temple." He says, you know, no shoes, no shirt, no service, no intoxication allowed here. And so she says, "No, I'm a woman of sorrowful spirit. I pour my out before the Lord. It's not there's no other explanation other than I need a blessing." And she's very heartfelt about this. That's text 2b. Text 2c, Rachel.
Rachel saw that she had not borne children to Jacob. Rachel became jealous of her sister. She said to Jacob, "Give me children, if not, let me die."
She says, to the point of, without children, she says, "If not, let me die. What's my life about?" Okay. So... the Torah, and we don't necessarily need Torah to tell us this, but Torah certainly emphasizes this idea that along with the struggle to have children comes intense emotions, pain, anxiety, perhaps sadness, a feeling of hopelessness. But there's a lot of emotions that come along with the struggle to have children. And it's therefore important, as I mentioned before, that there be possibilities for or options or people to speak to and to discuss the issues. In fact, there are studies that say that individuals that are struggling with infertility, the psychological impact is equivalent to cancer, cardiac rehabilitation, and hypertension patients. In other words, that's how intense the experience can be. So, counseling, therapy, having somebody to talk to is is exceedingly important. So it shouldn't be minimized, the intensity of the struggle. But in speaking with somebody that is going through this challenge, it's necessary to maintain a high level of sensitivity. Torah teaches us, perhaps from some negative examples, how not to speak to somebody in struggling with the inability, or right now with struggling with having to have children. Torah tells us two of the stories that we spoke about. The story of Rachel. Rachel tells her husband, Jacob. Rachel tells Yaakov, give me children. If not, what does she say? If not, let me die. What does Yaakov say back to her? What does Yaakov respond? Huh?
What I love,
that's not what he says. No, that's not what he says. That's it. Hasachas Elohim Anochi. Am I instead of God? That's what he said. Those three words. Hasachas Elohim Anochi. Am I, it's a rhetorical question. Am I instead of God? Am I in place of God? What's his answer? Some say, according to the Medrash, his response was, wait a second. I'm having kids with your sister Leah. It's not my problem. It's your challenge. You speak to God. You should daven. It's not my thing to daven for. He says, is it my place to intervene before God? You daven about it. It's your challenge. Because of that, the Medrash says that was not. The Medrash criticizes him for saying that. Takes him to task severely for saying that. According to the interpretation that's what he meant, that's what he's saying, according to one that says that's what he meant, it was a big problem that he said that. Another precedent that we find in Tanakh, in biblical literature, is the story that we mentioned before of Chana. Chana was married to a gentleman named Elkanah. Elkanah had another wife whose name was Penina. Penina, I think so. Penina. Penina had children. She had many children. And what would she constantly tell Chana? Oh, you must have so much time on your hands. I'm busy with the kids. So that's what it says. Why did she say that? To try to encourage her to daven harder for the blessing. So she had, according to the commentary, she had noble intentions on some level, and yet the story continues that many of her own children, Penina's children, died. And according to some, again, it's not me that's coming up with this and playing God. I'm just saying some commentaries draw a parallel between the way she was insensitive to Chana and Chana's inability to have children and the demise of her own offspring. Bottom line is we find in Torah examples of the struggle, the pain of the struggle, and also the degree of sensitivity needed when conversing, when communicating, when talking with somebody that is struggling with these challenges. Today, though, we are blessed with the advances of modern medicine, and there are many options that are available for couples struggling with infertility. As was mentioned before, there is artificial insemination, of which there are two types. There's artificial insemination donor, artificial insemination husband. There is in vitro fertilization, which could be from a donor or from the husband. And the difference is the artificial insemination is going inside the woman, whereas in vitro is being prepared in a laboratory. There is something called ICSI. ICSI is a form of in vitro, where the sperm is injected directly into the egg. Which is an option. One sperm is injected directly.
When there is a male factor.
Male factor infertility, yeah.
So before that was a problem, now you need just one good sperm.
And then it's actually manually inserted into the egg to fertilize it. Whereas before, IVF is just put in a dish and you kind of let nature take its course, so to speak, in the Petri dish. But this ICSI is actually targeted injection. There's surrogacy, as was mentioned. So there are options out there. And these options can give couples struggling with having children a renewed chance and different options to have children and be a parent. But what does Jewish law, what does halacha say about these options? It's a complicated question, as we'll see tonight, as we'll see today. Take a look at the poll question. I just want to get some preliminary feedback. Poll question is on the handout. You're not going to find them in the book. This is my poll question. I have two of them. Poll question number one. Which of these infertility treatments do you think Jewish law would permit? Circle the ones that you think are permitted. Do you have a copy? I have another handout. I got plenty here. Okay, so which of these do you think Jewish law would permit? And please circle on the handout which ones you think would be okay. Artificial insemination donor. Again, that's where a donor sperm, a third party sperm is artificial insemination via third party donor sperm. The second option is artificial insemination husband. That's where the husband's sperm is that which is being artificially inseminated into the woman, into the wife. C, in vitro fertilization. That's where the fertilization is happening in the lab, and surrogacy. That's where another womb is carrying the fertilized embryo. All right. By raise of hands, any of these permitted by Jewish law?
Any permitted?
Yeah. Which one's permitted?
B, C, and D.
B, C, and D. Okay. Anybody have A?
I'm sure that.
You have A. Okay.
Maybe all of them or none of them.
Okay. Okay. We're going to see, though, that there are nuances that apply to all the cases.
Because it depends if you have waste or not waste,
no? No, not necessarily. It's a good question. Talk about wasting of the semen.
Yeah.
For these treatments or to have children, that's typically not considered to be an issue. There are other issues that we're going to talk about.
It's not an issue.
Other considerations.
You don't use any sperm when you have natural sperm.
I can't give a psak here. I'm not going to say it's not, but I'll tell you, there's a letter that the Rebbe writes to somebody that asks, can he go through treatment because it requires samples, etc. Is it violating this prohibition of wasting seed, so to speak? So the Rebbe writes that usually I don't get involved in halachic issues, and whenever the Rebbe was asked halachic issues, he says, you got to ask a Rav. The Rebbe didn't view himself, he didn't take on the capacity of your local Orthodox rabbi, so to speak, or your local rabbi. He said, you know, ask your local rabbi or ask an expert in the field. But he said, in this case, I'm going to answer the question. He says, my father-in-law said that to have children, one is allowed to, at least this, to overlook. The question is, though, there are other issues out there. So let's explore. We're going to explore these various treatments and the issues that are involved from a Jewish perspective. But let's first look, by the way, just as an aside, so King Solomon was once asked a difficult question about a child, and his response was split the child. Today, modern medicine can split the mother. We have the ability to have an egg in one place and a woman in another place. So it's amazing what technology can do, what modern medicine can do. Question is, what does Jewish law say about it? Let's start first from the secular perspective. And I'll ask a question. And I don't know definitively the answer for the question, but I actually want to get input. The question is there a method out there that's available to conceive and have children that is not okay in secular society, in modern society? Are there any methods, any treatment options, anything that we would say, oh, you can't do that?
There's some difficulty with cloning.
Cloning. But cloning is not... Cloning is not the same as conception. I'm talking about conceiving a child.
You take a cell, you take one cell from a person, and you create a genetically equal person to that person. That's conceiving a child.
And what happens with that? It goes through gestation?
Well, they've done it with sheep.
I'm asking, does it go through the...
sheep did.
It goes through gestation in someone's womb.
In someone's womb. Okay. That's valid. Good. Actually, I said it. Okay. So cloning would be one. Outside of cloning,
buying children.
The human trafficking, is that's another issue.
So like paying two people. I mean, I know there's a serious. I'm thinking of it differently than surrogacy somehow.
Well, human trafficking is if
like,
yeah, if it's
for the conception part, not just for adopting a baby that's already been conceived.
Well, can you pay for a surrogate?
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
You can,
yeah.
For sure. So why is that not a human trafficking? I don't know. But what other than cloning and human trafficking?
Are you talking about like by secular moral? I mean,
yes.
Like secular moral.
Yes. Yes.
So probably
huh?
like to
or
pay.
Law, secular law.
Or secular law. Right. Is there anything that's like, oh, we can't do that? That's
probably like. Pay someone to sleep with you to impregnate you.
Why not?
Well, it's prostitution.
Oh, because that's money. Forget about the money, but that's already... Forget money. I'm talking about the ethics of what's happening. You're talking about a financial situation. You're talking about a financial thing put... Forget the financial part. The question is... That's what I mean. That's the point that I want to get to. That there's pretty much nothing that is socially or morally unacceptable when it comes to the attempt, the pursuit of having a child.
I don't think so.
About rape.
I mean, well,
no, of course not. No. I'm talking about when all parties. I should have mentioned when all parties are consenting. If all parties are consenting, is there anything that would be not okay?
Consenting and all parties are taking care and adults and are
correct.
Being taken care of.
Yes, yes.
And treated in a humane
yes.
way.
Yes.
With connection.
Yes.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
And
let's say yes.
No problem.
Then there's nothing. So the way what I want to trace it to is a distinction that we make often between rights versus mitzvot. That in secular society we look at things as a right, and in general we have rights. Having children is a big right. Look at text number 3. Mm-hmm. Text number 3. Deborah, can you please read this?
Men and women of full age without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion have the right to marry and to found a family.
This is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Okay, so in other words, everyone has the right to marry and to have a family. That right cannot be taken. So the question is this a negative right or a positive right? First of all, what's the difference between the two? A negative right means it's a right that no one can take away, no government can take away. A positive right means that it's actually positively enforced or reinforced by the government, by the law. So in other words, one law, if it's a negative right, it means that the government cannot step in and say, you cannot have children. Which country does say that?
China.
What does China say, though? That's right, you can't have more than one. So they're not taking away the right to have children. They're taking away the right to have multiple children. That's a different, there might be a distinction there.
Do countries sign on to agree to this?
I believe so. Yes, it's a UN document.
If it's a UN document, then why can't gay people be in here too?
This is a question that's outside the scope of A, my knowledge, and B, yeah, I don't know. It's a very good question. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Because I don't know if there was a law or if it was just a practice where people with mental disabilities weren't allowed to have...
And this is written for that?
No.
This doesn't address that. Okay, so I don't know the limit. I don't want to get into the...
I'm pretty sure the United States has not signed on to this also, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
It could be. I don't know. I don't know much about it. I know it's in here. They're putting it in.
Not always put in practice.
Right. So let's leave it at that. I just want to bring out the point that it's in general it's understood as a right that people have. In other words, the government cannot typically get involved and say, you can't have children. We cannot ban somebody from having children. Now, in the U.S., it's a negative right. In other words, the government cannot interfere. In other countries, such as Israel, it's actually a positive right. In other words, Israel, I don't know if you know this, Israel pays for infertility treatment. It's a positive right. Israel pays. The government pays for it.
What is negative and what is positive?
Negative means that they can't take it away from you. Positive means that they actually help you help you embrace that right.
I have a friend that at the time lived in Israel that at her job they would tell her, okay, it's time for you to go to your appointments. Just go. They were just like totally... So
Israel actually has one of the largest percentage of infertility treatments, people in that process in Israel. We're going to speak about that in a second in more depth.
Once it can afford it.
Right. Makes it a little bit easier. Yeah.
I know that if you don't, a couple who doesn't have any children, they pay treatment, which is in the States like $12,000 a pop, but they pay for that. If you don't have any children, they pay the full price. If you have one child, they pay half price for to have a second child.
Interesting.
And then after you have two children, they don't.
At that point, you're on your own time.
Yeah.
The mitzvah is fulfilled. You're on your own now. But it's interesting that there it's considered a positive rite. So secular ethics then... I want to give another example. So before I give the example. So because it's a rite, I want to... And you might reject this thesis, this idea, but this is where I'm going with this. Because it's a rite... So then, it's a right. The right, it's wide open. So anything, as long as it's consensual, it's available. It can be utilized. And I'll ask you another question. If you have, huh? Except for cloning. But why is cloning? Why was cloning considered? Why is cloning a problem? I have a theory. There's a theory about that.
But if that's the only way you can have children, they
because
my point was not to discuss cloning.
No, I'm with you. I'm asking you a question. Why is cloning theoretically a bigger issue than bringing in? If we want to look at it, what if married couple and they want to bring in another man into the relationship so that the woman can get pregnant? There's nothing. There's no secular issue with that.
But the government reserves the right to limit.
But what? So what I'm saying is maybe the reason is because the technology didn't outpace the ethical discussion. Whereas by cloning, because the technology schlepped, so there was a chance for the ethical discussion to... Huh?
That was just a funny terminology.
Well, you hear what I'm saying? You hear the part that I'm saying? When the technology jumps the ethical discussion, so it becomes acceptable. If the technology is dragged out... I'm not sure either. I'm saying let's discuss these issues. But I want to point out something. If you have sperm from one, three individuals, sperm here, egg there, womb there. Okay? All consenting. Who's the mother? What's the answer?
According to
society.
Secular law.
Yeah.
And many, because each state has different legal arrangements with this, but California, which is the most advanced state, and many others now, declare, you're the lawyers, I don't know the legal exactly terminology, but the person who's the mother is the person who files as the intentional parent.
That's the answer. You got to read the contract. The answer, who's the mother? Read the contract. See, this is where we are, and I'm not... Understand the concept that I'm pointing out. There's no ethical limitation right now on this. What it is if everyone agrees, then we're good. And if there's a question because there's the eggs from here and the wombs from there, you got to look at the contract. So whatever everyone agreed to. What I'm saying is there's no ethical objective standards here. It's except for cloning, which again we could have a theory for. But bottom line, it's wide open.
I do have one problem, it's an ethical problem.
Yeah.
If someone forgot to have children and remembers after 55, and the chances are that this person will leave a very young child without a parent.
Then they might stop it.
Then I see a problem.
Have the court stopped it? I can't imagine they would stop that.
Really? Between the two people, between mother and father, intended parents, you could not be more than 100 years old. Between mother and
father. Oh, really?
Yes.
Legally, they would stop. They would stop artificial insemination.
Like an 8-year-old man.
And a 20-year-old girl. 19.
Whatever.
If she's 19, it's kosher.
Surrogate and to give
if
the baby to this 80-year-old couple.
I got to look at... okay.
The parents have to be...
what if somebody doesn't ask the law? Are they going to... Are they taking away...
When you're going to the hospital and you're filing up...
So is this all states or is this a federal?
Most states. It's not federal.
So this I don't know. So but this is... Okay, so that... Okay. I just want to point out, though, the angle that I want to take is that it's a free-for-all because it's a right. It's a right, so all options are at my disposal. Pretty much, if we find one here, but pretty much it's all open. I want to contrast this. I want to, because we need to have the contrast. The contrast is with Jewish, the way Judaism looks at it. In Judaism, having children is not a right, it's a mitzvah. And it means something completely different. It's a mitzvah. It's the first mitzvah of the Torah. The first... Huh?
For men only.
No, there are some that say it's for women also. Hold on. Let's go to the sources, text 4. Irena, text 4. Page 119.
And God created man in his image, in the image of God. He created him male and female. He created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.
This is the first mitzvah, the mitzvah of to have children. Now, first the question was raised, is it a mitzvah to men or to women or to both? Huh?
Here it's not to men.
Here it doesn't sound like it's to men. There are those that say that it is only for men. Simple reason, because you can't be, no one can be obligated by Torah to perform a mitzvah that is that where pain and suffering is involved. So the woman gets a mitzvah, but she's not obligated to undergo pain and suffering. No one's obligated to undergo pain and suffering to do a mitzvah. That's not, according to some, that's the reason why you're not obligated. According to, again, it's a mitzvah, but the question is, again, mitzvah obligation, we've made the distinction before. Second thing is because some say, anyway, there's many ideas, but that's not really, the main point is that this is a mitzvah as opposed to a right. What's the mitzvah? Before we get into what's the mitzvah, it's not only is a mitzvah, but in text 5a, it's called the great mitzvah. Why is it called a great mitzvah? Because it's the source of all other mitzvot. Because without people, no one can do any mitzvahs. No one can do any mitzvot. So it's a great mitzvah, says Sefer HaChinuch, because it's a mitzvah that leads to the ability to perform other mitzvot. There's a mitzvah in text 5b. I'm just paraphrasing because it's not like to the medical discussion, to the legal discussion. Text 5b talks about a mitzvah to have even more than two children, if possible, if one can. Adding another soul to the Jewish people is like building a world. It's a mitzvah. It's a very important thing to have, not only children but as many children as you can. You know, we don't need to lead the world in zero population growth. That's the reality. The reality is, if you look at the numbers of Jews at the beginning of the 20th century. We were at 18 million. Today, we're at 14 million. That's it. And by the world growth, you know, by the you just take the numbers and you grow the numbers, we should be at about 30, 36 million. We're at 14. We don't need to lead the charge with zero population growth. So it's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. Text 5c, you have a messianic angle on it. Mashiach will come when the heavenly chamber is emptied of all its souls. Okay, so you have a messianic angle on it. Okay, point is, it's a big mitzvah. It's the first mitzvah, it's a big mitzvah. But I want to clarify, because the Talmud talks about when a person passes away, and they're asked several questions. I said this in the sermon on Rosh Hashanah. A person is asked several questions. Question number one is, after 120 years, question number one is, Nasata v'natata b'emunah. Were you honest in business? Question number two is? Kaveitim la Torah. First one is, were you honest in business? In your business dealings. Number two is? Kavatitim la Torah. Did you set aside time for Torah study? And the third is? Asakta b'friya v'rivya. Not that you have children. Asakta b'friya v'rivya. What does that mean? Did you try? Did you try to have children?
But again, this is only asked to men.
Are you sure? There's a dispute. I'm saying is it's discussed. It's not. It's not, some say the obligation that could be held against you is only for men. It's still a mitzvah for women for sure.
And so, what if you didn't try?
If it's a mitzvah to try, it's like
so
it's like any mitzvah.
Implication though, if you didn't.
No, I'm not going to go. Whatever. Fine. Bottom
line. The fact that you bring it up, it's important to know.
It's like any mitzvah. It's like any mitzvah. I mean, you have the same question for any mitzvah. It's like any mitzvah. What's the implication of you? I don't know. It's a mitzvah.
This is one of the three ones you get asked when you're.
There's four or five.
You know, yeah, I mean,
I don't know. I've never been in that situation. I don't know what the the Talmud doesn't then go on to discuss if this, it doesn't play out the end. The I don't know. I don't know what if the answer is the negative, what would be. I'm just saying that these, well, the point that I want to mention is that the mitzvah, again, it's not a right, it's a mitzvah, but the mitzvah is to try, which means that there's a mitzvah, that the mitzvah then is not an open mitzvah. That's the point, that's the central point I want to get to. The mitzvah is not a mitzvah at all costs. In other words, the mitzvah to save a life, we said you save a life at all costs. Okay? We said that you save a life at all costs, even if you're going to have to violate Shabbos. To save a life, you do it. But to conceive life, it's not the same. To conceive life, you don't violate other mitzvot in Torah. In other words, the mitzvah of having children is a mitzvah amongst the other mitzvot. So therefore, it's in Jewish law, it's going to be understood, it's going to be analyzed within the larger framework of Jewish values, ethics, and legalities. Does this make sense? So it's not going to be like, well, the technology is available, let's go for it. It looks a little bit, what's going on? Who's the parent? What's the halakha? Doesn't matter. Just go for it. You have the technology. Halakha is not, Jewish law is not going to look at it the same way. It's not a right that's open, that's a free-for-all. It's a mitzvah, like any other mitzvah, that has parameters to the mitzvah. So it's got, when does the mitzvah apply? When does it not apply? You're balancing. That's exactly my point. So the difference is between right, which is, again, this is the way I understand it. I'm presenting it. You could disagree, but for the purpose of this class, let's look at it this way. Where right would lend itself to being more open, and mitzvah lends itself to being more contained within the larger framework of, again, Jewish values, Torah, and mitzvah. Now, that's it. That's by way of introduction. That's just to give you the perspective of a rabbi that's being asked these questions. It's not going to be like, well, is it a viable, is it a good option? If it's a good option, it sounds good. It's going to be, is this consistent with Jewish values, with other mitzvot? That's going to be the question. Is it consistent with Jewish law and values? So let's jump straight into the actual discussion. Artificial insemination donor. The first treatment we'll look at is artificial insemination donor. Again, this is where the issue seems to be the husband. And so the treatment option is to take sperm from a donor, which is typically a third-party donor, typically an anonymous donor, and inject it within the woman to try to conceive. Artificial insemination donor. What, by the way, speaking of artificial insemination, do you know the first known literature to speak about artificial insemination in the world? The first known literature. Not Jewish literature. The first known literature to speak of artificial insemination. Do you know where that is?
I know the first treatment.
No. I'm saying the first time it was even discussed or mentioned as a possibility. The Talmud. The Talmud talks about a virgin becoming pregnant from going into a bath that had semen inside. Talmud talks about this possibility.
Is that actually possible?
No, I don't know if it's possible. I don't know if it's possible. But the Talmud entertains the concept. It's interesting. It opens up the discussion, at least on some level. What's the context? There's a halakha, there's a law that says that a Kohen Gadol, a high priest, can only marry a virgin. Question is, well, what if you have a virgin that went into this hot bath where there was semen present, and now she's pregnant? Which I said I used the phrase immaculate conception Tuesday night, but I got shot down. It's not, apparently it's not immaculate conception; it's virgin birth. It's a different concept. But I'm saying, from a guy from Pittsburgh, everyone knew about the immaculate reception. Who's with me? Football reference? Rocky Blood. Who is it? Franco Harris. There you go. Anyway. Moving back here. But the point is, whether it's medically feasible today, it doesn't make a difference. The bottom line is, and what's the Talmud's answer? Is she considered a virgin to marry the high priest or not? What do you think?
No. Huh? I would imagine they would say no.
Talmud says yes.
I would say yes.
Yes. She never had intercourse. Yeah, she never laid. She's still a virgin, even though she's pregnant, theoretically. But I just wanted to bring out the first text that talks about artificial insemination on some level. That's where they got the idea from, is the Talmud. The known in the world, the first known. Okay, anyway, getting back to our discussion. Artificial insemination donor. Again, I hope everyone has clear what the technology is, at least the basics. If a halachic posek, rabbi, is is thinking about this treatment option. What might be some considerations as to why it would not be okay?
6%.
What do you have? Is it? I'm saying, okay, but that's one consideration.
Well, it's not real. I mean,
if she's married,
if it's done artificially, no. But I could see where they might think if someone else's sperm enters her, that it could be perceived that
maybe,
way.
Maybe right. Maybe it's violation of the bond of marriage. Maybe it's somehow damaging the bond. Maybe it's some form of adultery. Perhaps that's one consideration. Let's discuss, you know what, instead of mentioning the three that we're going to talk about at once, let's just go through one at a time. So that's the first one. Text 6 is from Leviticus, where the prohibition against adultery, one of the times the Torah talks about the prohibition against adultery is mentioned. So it says, you shall not lie carnally giving seed to your neighbor's wife. What does it mean?
But now, because it says like this, now I think it's okay to do...
Why? Because it says... The question is the Torah saying one phrase, or can you split it and say it's banning both? In other words,
still giving seed to your neighbor.
Right, exactly. In other words, do you need both factors to be prohibited? Is it carnally and giving seed, or is it carnally and giving seed? In other words, and or giving seed. In other words, is there the and or is there the and? In other words, do you have to have both? In other words, is it only through sexual intercourse and that traditional mode of giving seed that there's a problem? Or is it even not carnally, as long as there's giving seed? So, it's a debate. There's a debate. Wait a second. Yeah?
Because even if you split it, then you could also say, oh, well, you could lie carnal with someone, and, you know...
You're going to do what?
Then you could lie carnally as long as he doesn't give the wife a seed. You know, like, if you
one
way,
right,
then you can split it the other way, too.
Good. So Rabbi Waldenberg, who's a big rabbi, we've had him before, Eliezer Waldenberg, he writes like this, that it's not conclusive from this verse if the Torah is prohibiting also the giving of seed, and it was removed from the act of carnal lying, whatever. But because we don't know, and because it might also be problematic biblically, we have to be very... It's an issue to think about. In other words, one might say that it is biblically prohibited based on this verse. One might say that it's not biblically prohibited. But can you tell me conclusively that that's not the Torah's intent? Can you say that it's iron shut, that it's cut and dry, you know, door slammed shut, that no, that's not at all what the Torah said? When it says giving seed, it means only in the context of carnally. Can you rule out that possibility? The answer is probably not. You can't rule out the possibility that the Torah was also including just the giving of seed as problematic. Since you cannot rule that out as even a possibility, so that becomes an issue. I'm not going to say it becomes banned. I'm saying it becomes an issue. Yeah.
If we're going to be that like this, we can just ban everything by saying neighbor's wife. It's never going to be the neighbor.
I had that question since then also. Good. You never. First of all.
It was the neighbor.
First of all. How do you know?
Instead of going through all the expense. Yeah.
Right.
And how do you define neighbor though?
Right. So typically, the neighbor. No. You're right. You ask the question. I got the question Tuesday night as well. Neighbor is not taken
literally.
Neighbor is taken as fellow. And as love your neighbor as yourself doesn't only mean the person living on that side and that side. The guy down the block, I hate him. Can't stand him. Slash the tires, key the car. He's not part. I know. Yeah.
Are there something to be said for anonymous versus a known donor? Like,
ooh.
A neighbor versus not neighbor.
Good question, but that might be another issue, anonymous. There's another issue involved with that. We need to talk about this. This is a very good point, but hold on. Good. It's like... Alright. So issue number one, I'm not saying therefore it's not, I'm saying the consideration let's form it instead of a statement as a question. Might artificial insemination from a donor be considered as a trespass on the sanctity of the marriage bond? Now, might it be considered trespassing, perhaps in the domain of adultery? That's question number one. Question number two is: might artificial insemination donor start severing the actual institution of marriage? Now, might it start harming the institution of marriage if there's an option to get pregnant from sperm donors, third-party donors? So, what do I need the
What do we need that guy that's driving me nuts in the first place?
You didn't say anything about adoption, though. I mean, if you don't need...
You could.
You could.
But let's look at something. I just want to bring up Israel. I mentioned Israel before. In Israel, 80%... I want Renata to hear this. In Israel, 80% of women that are undergoing infertility treatments are single women.
Really?
80%.
And will the country pay for it?
I believe so. I don't know. I'm not sure. Actually, that I don't know. But I know for a fact, 80% of... 80%, that's a very large number.
But is it single and living in a relationship?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
You don't have to be single.
I think it's single. But I'm not saying therefore it's a problem. I'm saying it's a consideration. There's what will, if again, halacha is saying, is not looking at it as a right. It's looking at it as, there's a mitzvah, but the mitzvah has to be understood within what are the ramifications of allowing this open. If you allow this open and it causes to tear down or to in any way diminish the institution of marriage, how does that play in? And we don't say, but to have a child is a great, because marriage is also a mitzvah. So now you have to weigh two mitzvahs, the values of two mitzvahs against each other. It's a different way of looking at it, as opposed to an absolute right that I can do it. Number three, the third issue. I hope I'm making sense here. Again, these are just issues that are being considered. Issue number three that's going to be considered is, might this lead to potentially incestuous relationships?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to in text 7.
That's text 7. That's the big one. Text 7 talks about the business traveler. The guy that's working in LA and New York. And you know what? He's a family man. You know what? He's got two families. He's got, because he spends a week here and a week there, but he doesn't want to be away from his family, so he does the next best thing. He's got two families. He's got one in the East Coast and one in the Left Coast. So biblically, polygamy was allowed. Rabbinically, that's been banned for a few thousand years. But biblically, theoretically, polygamy is allowed. So what happens if a man has a wife and kids in one place and a wife and kids in another place? The Talmud says, halacha says, Jewish law says, it's not okay.
Is it okay or
it's not okay? Why? Because if the families don't know each other, eventually they might meet, the kids that don't know of the other family, they might meet, fall in love, get married, and it turns out you're marrying your half-brother or half-sister, which is biblically prohibited. Biblically prohibited to marry a half-sibling or to have an intimate relationship with a half-sibling. Now, the problem is, this is an issue today on various levels. Whether it's closed adoption or anonymous sperm or egg donation. The problem exists and it becomes a halachic issue. It becomes an issue where if you cannot set up a situation that might lead to potentially biblical prohibition. You can't open up the door without a safeguard. So that's what they say. You can't marry, you can't have families, again, considering polygamy, assuming polygamy was okay, you cannot have two families in different places. But I'm going to make sure that they know each other. No, you cannot do it. I don't care that you say that you're going to take care of it. If we open it up, the guy that's not going to be careful could lead to a problem. So what we're saying here is, let's consider if this might be an issue when you have artificial insemination from an anonymous donor. Because we don't know who the dad is. And this kid might marry their half-sibling at a later time. Again, it's the same issue with closed adoption. It's the same issue with egg donation, with anonymous egg donation. It would be the same issue. In other words, once you're bringing in an anonymous party into the genetics of the child, the question becomes, what is the safeguard? Or can you allow without a safeguard? Now, if we establish that every couple, every prospective couple that's getting married, or before there's any intimate relationship in today's world, there has to be a DNA test to make sure that there's no sharing of, then maybe that's a safeguard. But in absence of that, can halacha give clearance to a situation that may lend itself? You can't set up a potentially biblical prohibition without any safeguards. That's the point. Or let's consider if you can or not.
What about if it's open?
If it's open, that would be less of a problem. If it's open, then this issue falls away.
Adoption seems like a bigger problem than...
Adoption is, it's a challenge, but not if it's an open adoption. If it's an open adoption, so halacha would favor, strongly favor, forcefully favor, open adoption.
that the children need to know who their biological parents are. And it has to be known. If somebody wants to get married and they ask me to marry them, I got to do a check to make sure that the first thing you got to make sure that they're allowed, that is that how likely they're allowed to marry the person that they want to marry. So if there's adoption, you got to go back. So if it's open, it makes things much easier. The question is, can you set up a situation where it might lead to, if it's closed and no one talks about it, no one knows about it, that seems to be halakhically problematic.
What do you do with closed adoption?
I don't know.
But you would marry someone who...
closed and you can't trace and you don't know?
Right. But people, assuming they're converted to Judaism.
I was adopted.
Oh, conversion that way?
They have to be Jewish for you to marry them.
Right. That's another issue. Oh, yeah. The conversion is another issue. I'm talking about
you don't have 100% that it's not their half.
That's not their half sibling. I'm saying, let's talk about it from the incestuous angle, from the prohibition against incest, the biblical problem with incest.
So it just hasn't happened to come up for you, where you've had.
It hasn't. No, it hasn't come up with me personally. But I know it's an issue.
How would you test for that?
Right. So you could maybe you can test the prospective mates. But think about it. Can you even get into any physical? Yeah. Not that a rabbi would condone a physical relation before marriage anyway, of course not. I'm just saying that, not that anybody here would, but I'm saying that...
A does not know who his parents are.
So that's a good question.
He doesn't know his parents.
Right, how do you know? It becomes problematic. No, person A...
He's adopted and he has no clue.
No clue. Can he get married in Jewish law? Can he get... Let's say he converted. Let's say he converted on his own. Let's make it simple. He converted, but you don't know who his parents are.
Genetic testing.
So then you
sometimes people commit adultery and they're you don't know for sure. You know, my dad says he's my dad, he kind of looks like my dad, but maybe he's not my dad. But we don't
go out of our way to look for issues.
Look for trouble.
But
yeah.
Of course not. But if somebody says, hey, this is straight up, this is my deal, I really don't know who my dad is or who, let's say dad. I don't know who my dad is. I'm not saying they can't get married. I'm saying it needs to be worked out now. I'm sure there are ways to work. I haven't dealt with it personally, but I'm sure there are ways to work it out eventually. But can you open up and say, put a hexer on it, say this is kosher, this is okay, if it's going to lead to confusion in this area? And I want to, before I take your question, I just want to point out text 8. Is a story from the UK. Twins who were separated at birth and raised by different families met later and married, but were forced to break up when they discovered their true identities.
Twins
who were separated at birth. This is a true story.
Oh my God. Can you imagine?
This is not from The Onion. This is a real story. This is tragic. This is tragic. I'm just saying. How did they find out? I don't know. When they did come to know their true identities, it led to having a separate and a heartbreak. Look, and the point is, later on in the text, it says, look at the paragraph that says this isn't a regular occurrence. This isn't a regular occurrence, obviously, but it could become one with large numbers of people now being born by IVF and not knowing their true identities. In other words, it's not only the rabbis that are saying this is a consideration or a potential issue. It's everyone that has an open mind is saying, look, in the pursuit of our right to have children, maybe we overlooked opening up some sort of Pandora's box. I'm not saying therefore it's not okay. I'm saying this is a consideration to take into account. How kosher is this, halakhically, to do so without any safeguards in a closed way with anonymous? So therefore, based on, I'm just going to wrap up and then I'm going to take a question. Based on all of these factors, the issue of, well, maybe it's adultery if you're introducing somebody else's seed into the woman. Maybe it's going to harm the institution of marriage, which is also a mitzvah. Maybe it's going to lead to questions, ambiguity as far as the identity of children and who they can marry. Because of all this, it becomes a very questionable option, halakhically. There are some that say that it cannot be done. Therefore, halakhically, it cannot be done. There are some that say that it certainly cannot be done as a first resort, but only maybe as a last resort, depending on the specific circumstances. Moshe Feinstein seems to write that under certain circumstances, if all other options with the husband and the ICSI, which is now available for male factor infertility, if all of the options are exhausted, then this can be a consideration and perhaps allow it. But again, there's serious halachic issues with this form of infertility treatment. Yes?
Oh, I was just going to say when we were talking about if one is a closed adoption and
yeah.
there's no
yeah.
way to trace, you could just go to the other person that they want to marry and make sure that their parents never were sperm donors or egg donors.
Is there documentation that says that at no point in time, unless you trust... Okay.
You go with the known person. If one person's unknown, you go...
But I'm saying, how do you know the known? That's my question.
How do you ever...
The known is the other part. The man and the woman. Man doesn't know who his parents are.
What I'm saying is, how do you know... The parent says, the dad says, well, the father of the bride says, I was never a sperm donor.
Right.
There's no documentation for that.
Because
the question doesn't come up.
But
the question doesn't come up. If the question is when the question's on the table, it has to be addressed. Until the question on the table, you assume a certain assumption. When the question on the table and you have to prove definitively that her father is not his father, how do you prove it definitively?
Because he just told you he's never been a sperm donor.
He told you. So DNA, that might be an answer. That might be the answer. He didn't prove it. He didn't prove it. You asked him. There's no proof.
Well, you can't prove that he didn't sleep with that woman.
Again, right. So in a typical situation, you don't assume that Mukhtanim were sleeping with each other before they... Mukhtanim means the two families were fooling around and then their kids... But you don't even have to ask for that. You don't have to ask, did your parents have an affair? The assumption is no. But in a situation where there's an unknown status of one of the...
But I'm saying you go with the known person.
You'd have to... He'd have no reason to... He wouldn't lie.
If one is unknown and...
Maybe, well, of course he has a reason to lie.
There's a reason to get an affair.
The unknown...
Yeah.
There's
an affair if he did it, if he for some reason didn't, I don't know. Look, it's a good point. It's a possibility. It's a possibility. It may be, I would say that there's a way to deal with it. I'm just saying, do you open it up and say, well, therefore, closed adoption is fine, artificial insemination donor, it's fine, it's not a problem. There's issues to discuss. It's definitely not first option. Okay. Artificial insemination husband seems to be a better option. On all three counts, let's go through. I was going to ask it as a question, but let's just.
Well, can I just say it almost seems like it'd be better to do artificial insemination with a known donor.
Yeah.
Correct. And open. Yeah, that would take away which issue?
The potential incest.
Right. It wouldn't take away the first two issues. It wouldn't take away the perhaps lying currently giving seed issue. Is this giving seed a problem biblically? It wouldn't take away the problem of deinstitutionalizing or.
Right.
Whatever, potentially harming the institution of marriage, because then as long as I know the donor, it's fine. So the first two issues, that's why I gave a potpourri of issues, or consideration, maybe issue sounds too hard, considerations, it satisfies the third, correct, it's better.
Which one? Which
the third of not knowing the parents, and therefore, so it satisfies...
You don't know who that donor slept with also. I mean, if it's...
Right. Right, thank you, right. It's right, there's still... Right, but then you don't know who...
So you're assuming
it's yeah, okay.
the father of the person you're going to marry, you're okay. That's as far as you can go.
Yeah. We may... that. I hear your point. It's a good point. Okay, it may satisfy the third issue, but we still have the other issue. But if it's a husband, so you... at first glance, you don't have any of the issues. Why? It's not adultery. Because the husband. Again, what's happening here is that through traditional ways of conception, it's not working. So they say, we'll take the sperm, and we'll artificially inset, we'll put it in.
That seems completely wrong.
So it's not adultery, it's the husband. It's not a third party. Whether known, it's not breaking the bounds of marriage, they're married. And it's not, and it's not leading to incest, because you know the parents, you know the mother and the father. There's no problem. So it seems to be not a problem. What's the problem that might...
Sacred.
That's, you know what, that's not high on the list of considerations. The sacred act of procreation, the traditional act of sacredness of procreation. They can do that too. Good, they can do that too. But that doesn't seem to be an issue. The issue are you violating another mitzvah or compromising another mitzvah or violating a prohibition? That's really, those are the considerations.
Just out of curiosity, though, is there a blessing or something that's done so that there is a sacredness about it?
It's a good question. I don't, from what I understand...
Which one?
She's saying it sounds very mechanical when the artificial insemination... Is there... Because there could be a holiness in the act of... of physical intimacy, man and woman, but in the act of artificial insemination, is there a way to make it more spiritual? I don't know. I don't know how it's done. Let's hear from Irena.
The issue, from what I understand, is there is another issue, which is the issue of modesty. So that comes up. So
modesty, we can disregard.
Well,
on some level. In general. Oh no! Wait a second. You're right. Scratch that from the record. Timestamp delete. I need one of those 5-second buzzers that they have on radio. 20 seconds.
What I do know in New York, when there is very orthodox people doing treatment, is they do need to have the rabbi involved.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about that in a second. Yeah.
Okay. Go. And the issue of the seed being wasted, there is a special way of collecting
from postcoital. Postcoital, they. No, if you want it, if artificial insemination husband, so you need semen from the husband, right. Need sperm. So they, instead of him donating it in a way that would be considered perhaps wasting seed, they collect it from the woman post intimacy.
It's not wasting if it's being used.
That's what the Catholics do too.
Again, there's some that say that you need to do, some that say you don't need to do it.
Don't do that just in regular.
No.
No,
that's how they get it. You can either get it in a right. Okay, but I want to put so it seems like artificial insemination husband. There's no issues, at least the issues that we mentioned before. There's no issue of adultery. There's no issue of breaking the bonds of marriage, and there's no or you know the institution, and there's no issue of unknown parentage. The one issue that there is, though, I just want to set this out. The one issue that there is, though, is the lab mix-up. That's exactly what we're talking about. This is the issue. Theoretically, it's fine. But practically, it can be problematic. Why can it be problematic? Because it's happened many times. In fact, there are hundreds of cases a year.
Hundreds.
In the UK alone, last year, there were 338 incidences of various mix-ups. Some to the point of getting the wrong embryos implanted in the wrong woman.
Make sure they all have their
safeguards. But halacha, so I just want to say halacha. Wait. There's still a possibility of error. One second. There's still a possibility of error. We text 9A is the story of the woman, the white woman who gave birth to a white child and a child from an African American mother because it was mixed up. Text 9B talks about mishandling of eggs and embryos and the fact that urine labs that collect urine samples and process that have more regulations that are enforceable than fertility labs. Fertility labs, there are today, this was in 97, this text 9B. You got to read this stuff outside of class. We don't have time to read it. We're just not going to get through the material. Text 9B talks about the fact that there are no regulations. Well, today there are regulations. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine has regulations, the guidelines, but there's no way to enforce it. There's no body that's enforcing right now, today. There is no body that's overseeing and enforcing any regulations at any fertility clinics. It's up to their own discretion. So the individual could be told, choose a good one. But halacha would say, we got to put something into place. And therefore...
Any given clinic has only done this once.
Say it again?
Any given clinic...
Because once they do it, they're out of business. It makes sense. But the bottom line is there is this margin of error. So what does halacha say about a margin of error that could lead to having the wrong, again, if the issue is adultery, let's say, because the wrong sperm is going into the wrong, foreign sperm, foreign seed into the woman, into the married woman. So then what about implanting an embryo from another couple? That's also highly problematic. The fact that the possibility exists creates a halachic problem. So therefore, most rabbanim say the way to get around the problem, again, theoretically, it's not a problem if it's with the husband. The only problem is, what if the lab messes up? The halachic way to around that is by having a mashkiach. Mashkiach, literally, somebody, Mashkiach means a supervisor. Like you have a caterer that's preparing a thing. So you don't trust the caterer, it's a kosher caterer. You got to have a third party objective outside. Yes. Yes. Oh, wait. There's two questions. First of all, is that mandated? 99% of Rabbanu, I don't think there's any Rav today that says it's fine without. You trust the clinic, they're kosher. You need a third party independent individual that's overseeing. So the stickers are great, but I'll ask you another question. Are medical professionals concerned about infectious diseases passing from one patient to another? Yeah. Are they concerned? Of course they're concerned. Is it problematic? Are they pained when that does happen? Of course. Does infection spread in hospitals? All the time. How does it spread if they care about the patients? How does it spread? Because they don't wash their hands properly. But why didn't they wash their hands properly? They care. Their position is worrying about health. How could they not wash their hands properly? And it's traced. A majority, 90% of the cases, because due to poor hand washing techniques or practices. So how does that happen if they're healthcare professionals and they care about lives and health? And you ask them, do you care about health? Yes. How'd they not wash their hands? What's the answer? It's simple. Because they're human. Because they made a mistake. Because they were running from one thing to another. The point
that the Mashkiach doesn't have to watch all the intimate details.
Right. No, but the point is that you need an outside body overseeing it to halakhically eliminate the margin of error. There's a margin of error. There's human error.
And there are people who do that. Like there's in Atlanta. Yeah. Is that available?
I don't know if in Atlanta, but I'm sure in New York. I'm sure in New York there are individuals. Look, and to be a Mashkiach, you got
to...
That's the next question. That's the next question. The question is, so what will the lab say? If the labs, if your doctor says, if a fertility doctor says to a patient, to a couple, says, these are the treatments, and the couple says, well, based on my religious beliefs and consultation with my rabbi, but based on my religious principles, we need an outside supervising party, third party, that's not affiliated with this clinic or with this, that's going to oversee and make sure that there's no foreign gametes, there are no foreign cells and organic material being ultimately put into her body. So some clinics will say, we respect that. Some will say, what are you talking about? The rabbi will advise in this situation, find a lab that cares about all of your needs. Because if there's a doctor, if there's a clinic that does not care about your religious beliefs, maybe they're not the right ones to treat you because they're not treating the whole person. Look at text, I just want to bring out this text, text 10C. Health professionals who are not personally familiar with or committed to the limitations that are integral to their patients' religious commitments can be incredulous that such restrictions could be allowed to frustrate or complicate the fertility therapy if the couple had a real desire to conceive. In other words, they might say to the patient, you want to have kids? So stop your Baba Maisa. Stop hacking at China about third parties and rabbis. You want the treatment? This is the treatment. And if you really cared about having a child, you would follow our advice to the T. So this text is saying, really? Such value judgments have no place in the patient-doctor relationship, as we all know. Fertility therapy, like all legitimate medical therapy, must address the patient as a whole. The religious commitments of a patient may be at the core of his or her personal identity. Understanding these commitments can help the physician construct the therapy protocol best suited for the patient at hand. In other words, it's not only within best religious practice, it's consistent with best medical practice to treat the whole person. If the person has a strong beliefs, core beliefs that dictate that, Jewish law has something to say about potential foreign genetics being put into this woman, and therefore we need a third party. If the doctor is not okay with that, the advice is you find a doctor that is. There are many that are, and the mashkichim are not necessarily the ones that are by catering events. It's not the, you know what I mean to say is it could be a food mashkiach is just somebody making sure there's no pork being rolled in and just checking, you know, all the seals. The mashkiach in this case would most probably be somebody that has familiarity in medicine, maybe a doctor, maybe a medical professional themselves. So it's somebody that the lab or the doctor may very well respect as a colleague. The point is, the qualification is somebody that cares about halacha and somebody that's a third party is not being paid by that lab. That's it. But it becomes a critical, what's the word I'm looking for? First step, prerequisite for artificial insemination husband. One, we're going to conclude with embryonic stem cell research.
we're going to conclude quickly with that. Because why does embryonic stem cell research come in? Because you have embryos. Let's say IVF, in vitro fertilization. In vitro, you create, sure, you create embryos, and then some are implanted. How many are implanted? Today, many countries, in the UK, Canada, and Australia, the countries, the government have strict control over how many are allowed to be implanted, and they limit it at 2. Because of the complications that can happen with multiple pregnancies, they say even though it's a shot and you don't know which ones are going to take, whatever, only implant 2. What do you do if there's, but you start off with more, you're always starting off with more and then you're hoping that, so what if you start off with several, many, and you're not implanting them, what do you do with the embryos? So it becomes a debate because now, today, there's these embryos are valuable for their stem cells. You could do research illness, genetic illnesses like Parkinson's disease, diabetes. These embryos are very valuable from a medical research standpoint. But once you pull out the stem cell, you destroy the embryo and the potential of life there. How luckily is this problematic? So if we know the debate that happened, that exists across the U.S., the religious debate, Bush, Obama, Barnes and Deal. You know, these debates are all over the place. Is embryonic stem cell research okay? Is it not okay? Can the government fund it or can it not be funded because the government can't fund destruction of life and human life? Halacha looks at it from a unique perspective. Question number one is, when does life begin? So some say at birth. If it's at birth, hold on one second, some say that. Some say at birth. If you say at birth, then it's not a problem because then it's before birth. If you say it's before birth, then it becomes problematic unless you say it's only after 40 days after conception. So typically embryos are frozen before 40 days after conception. If, though, life begins right away at conception, so maybe it's a problem with these embryos to destroy them or to allow for their destruction through research. Halakha looks at another consideration, which is an embryo in a lab, in a test tube, the same as an embryo implanted within a woman? In fact, there's terminology that terms one pre-embryo and one embryo. Depending on your religious leanings, you might call one an embryo as well. But the way Judaism looks at it is one is a pre-embryo and one is an embryo.
Which one is
it? The embryo in the test tube that's been fertilized, sperm and egg, fertilized in a test tube in a lab, is a pre-embryo. Halachically, it's not an embryo. In fact, one of the verses, the biblical verse that lends itself to the prohibition against abortion, the biblical problem with abortion is the verse that says "Shofech dam ha'adam be'adam." It's spilling the blood of a human within a human. In other words, the prohibition is shedding blood of a person within a person, but not shedding the blood of a person outside of a person. So, an embryo in a lab, halachically, does not have the same status as one that's already implanted in the woman, in the mother. So therefore, halachically, there is no problem. I'm really just paraphrasing because I really want to make sure we're ending. But just to paraphrase, and you can read all the text about it. Halacha does not have a problem with destroying embryos that are in a lab. It does not have the status of life. The basic distinction would be on its own what's going to happen with it. It can survive. That's not really the critical thing. What's going to happen to it? Is it going to develop into a life? An embryo that's implanted within a woman by natural means is going to develop into a life. There's gestation. It's going to be born. I mean, hopefully, if all goes well, but it's going to naturally develop into it. And in a laboratory, at that point, nothing's going to happen. So halacha does not give it the same status of life as an embryo that's implanted. There's a big distinction between lab and mother. Embryo in a lab and embryo in a mother. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
This distinction? So Judaism takes a very liberal, if you want to call it liberal, approach to stem cell research and says, not only is it not a problem, so A, there's halakhically, there's not a problem in destroying them, theoretically, if you need. But B, the second step would be, why destroy it if you can save life through it, through research? So it actually becomes advisable to use the embryos for stem cell research. It becomes advisable and preferable to use. And how many embryos are out there in the world today? Frozen. Millions. I think 1.3 million. So we don't need to clone. Creating embryos just for medical research, we don't have to be worried about that. There's plenty that are sitting there, frozen. So there's plenty out there.
that, so again, to leave them is not halakhically prohibited. It's not problematic. To destroy them, it's not a life. You're not destroying life. To use them for research, it's a good thing. That's what halakha says about it. I told you might be surprised.
Very interesting. I am surprised. I wouldn't be sure how to break the news to a patient. So,
like, about what?
Clinically.
About which part?
Their embryos are going to be used for research.
For research? Which part?
That's the part that you say...
I just want, because I know some folks have to go. Thank you for being here. Next week, we're not having the Thursday class because of Thanksgiving. We'll have the Tuesday class for those that want to do the Tuesday. The Thursday sessions will resume the following week. So we're not missing a class. We're just pushing it off by a week. This Saturday night, everyone is invited to Cafe Chabad, kosher by candlelight dinner starting at 8, followed by Judaism and Astrology, a workshop, a presentation on the Jewish view of the zodiac, the stars. Is it kosher to consult a horoscope, palm reading? Is it not kosher? Is it real? Is it not real? What is there a message to your sign, Kabbalistically, spiritually? That's Saturday night, 8 o'clock. More information online, you can sign up by the door. Go.
People go through IVF,
yes,
and have all these embryos left, like they had like 10,
yes,
good, and they used 2,
yeah,
and so they have 8,
yes,
and they saw them and they put names to them and
they become attached to it.
They become attached to it.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure how I will just
tell them to keep it frozen. Keep it. They don't have. They don't have to destroy it. They can keep it. They don't. Halacha doesn't say you have to destroy it.
No, but then you have to pay every year. It's heartbreaking. You have to pay.
So that's their own decision. What I'm saying is, halachically, it's not an issue. To keep them maintained. To keep them in it. Halakhically, it's not a problem. It's not a problem. Halakhically, it's not. Halakhically, it's okay.
So, yeah, saving it 2 years later is not a problem.
It's fine. Yeah, in fact,
they completed their family. They completed their family.
Right.
And now. I'm so sorry.
No worries. I'm just telling you to tell me.
Hello? I'm sorry.
No worries.
Can I call you right back?
So there's nothing.
I'll call you right back.
Weird about saving it for later and using.
Okay.
It. I don't see any halachic issue with it. Somebody told me Tuesday night that they know somebody who their second child is actually older genetically than their first. In other words, it was from an earlier round of treatment or whatever. They had it a few years later. They had that child a few years later.
Well, what about just freezing the egg?
That's not a problem.
Making a fresh.
Halachically, there's no. I haven't seen a problem with it.
With freezing the eggs, but it's not a technique that's very.
They'd rather freeze embryos than eggs.
Right. It's not.
They'd rather go.
Not, they're not very high up with it. They're doing that with chemo patients.
It's preserving,
not just
right.
Just a technique that. It's 100% embryos. That there's a very good chance it will work. Freezing eggs.
Right, it's still the unknown. It's still only one half of the equation.
What about, where is we on the surrogacy one?
It's a very good question. There's a halakhic debate going on. According to some rabbis, the child is considered to have two mothers, halakhically. It's a suffix. It's a doubt. According to some, it would be half. It would only have a status of half maternally Jewish, and they would have to. The child would have to have a conversion, even though the caring mother, even if the caring mother is Jewish, but the egg was donated from a non-Jewish donor. So there are some that say you go by the birth mother.
Or if the egg was Jewish, but the surrogate mother was
a surrogate.
Okay, so that becomes even more. That becomes a little bit more questionable. There's some that say that it's half and half. It's again the question. I've looked into egg donation from a halachic thing. I'm trying to get back a response.
If you don't know if it's closed.
Right. If it's closed, yeah, that could theoretically be a problem. You don't have the problem of adultery theoretically because it's a husband is allowed to have two wives, at least biblically. There are. It seems like there may. I'm still researching the topic of as far as egg donation. If another party donated the egg, now it's being carried,
and it's fertilized, and it's fertilized by the husband's sperm.
Right.
And then it's implanted in the wife.
Right.
So, A, what's the halachic status of the child? Because typically Jewishness is maternal, by the mother. But here, who's the mother? Is the mother, as I asked the question before, is the mother the caring mother or the egg mother? So some, I think one of the Mordechai Eliyahu, one of the big rabbis in Israel, says that halachically it's a question mark. So it's a suffix. It's actually a doubt as to who is the mother. So it's we say half mother here, half mother there. So the child would have to go through a conversion to be considered 100%.
Do we know where it came from? Where is it? Because
oh, what's the rationale behind it?
Yeah.
I don't see. That's what I'm saying. I'm still researching to get all the rationale. I'm getting there's a message, but I'm getting some information. I'm not getting an exhaustive breakdown of the issues involved here regarding the sperm donation part of it or the sperm. You know, for the male fertility issues. That was we were heavily involved there in this lesson on that angle.
It doesn't matter as much if it's a matrilineal descent issue. Then it matters much more if it's who the donor was. If you're, I thought it was the woman who carried the babies.
Some say that, but some say that it's because the egg is coming from somebody else. The biological. The question is, what's the biological? It's a question. The question is still out there. I'll ask you another question. I mean, you raised the question about the emotional attachment that one might have to their 8 out of 10 embryos.
Yeah.
And again, halachically, halacha says, okay, the attachment it's fine. That's something that they're going to have to decide what makes them most comfortable. But again, halachically, it's not a problem to keep them or to destroy them or to use them for research. Halacha gives the okay because it's not yet life. On that, on the level, the same level as life inside a woman.
Intended for life, like at that moment. So it just.
But it's a difference. Again, the halacha will draw the line between what will grow on its own or develop on its own to actually be a live human being to something that still is missing a step. There's still a step missing. It's not like it's not the ball is not rolling yet on this. Started, you took the first step. There's obviously some sort of potential of life, but it's not halakhically different than just the sperm on its own, or just the egg on its own. Okay. Even though it's fertilized, maybe without implantation, it still has the same status as the genetic material as it was before the fertilization. The halakha would liken it more to that, sperm, semen on its own, than an embryo implanted in a woman. I'll ask you another question. Embryonic selection. Are you allowed to pre-select? Mm-hmm. Embryonic selection. You run a course of treatment. And you get 10 to choose from. You have 5. 5 that worked out. 5 to choose. And you're only going to choose 2. 2 are going to be implanted. Let's say this is what's going to happen. So what do you... So they know they can tell the genders. Am I right?
Yeah.
You can tell the genders.
Yeah. From the embryo?
Yeah.
Embryo?
Yeah. For sure. For sure, you can tell. Yes, there's pre-selection that can happen. You can even tell hair color. You can tell lots of things. You can tell hair color.
You can choose for a gender.
That's right. That's right. Are you allowed? So let's say you have 4. Let's just make it an even number, 4, and you're only going to do 2. And there's 2 boys potentially, and 2 girls potentially. Halachically, is it problematic to say I want the 2 girls, or I want the 2 boys, or I want 1 and 1? Is it problematic? Would Judaism then to take what you mentioned? Yeah, the mitzvah is fulfilled with one of each. I mean, again, the mitzvah is to try. Which, by the way, we didn't do the whole end of the lesson, which is all about if you can't and you don't, you've tried and trying. You're not held accountable for something that's outside of your control. No one is. But that's not the point. Is it advisable then halachically to choose the one and the one? Or is it up to you? Or is it? Or you're not even allowed to look? You just have to say whatever you do is fine. Can you? Are you allowed to make that choice? It's a complicated question. I haven't seen a valid reason to prohibit the choice, even though it seems a little bit uncomfortable. To like pre-selection. It's almost like you're playing a little bit too much playing God. Although we had somebody in medical field Tuesday that said that in general girls have less of a shot at certain diseases and illnesses, so it might be preferable, especially if there's a family history towards certain things, to choose the 2 females.
So halachically, it's 1 and 1.
The mitzvah is fulfilled with 1 and 1.
Yeah. So is there why I've heard.
I haven't done the mitzvah yet.
No. I have.
So it's like a three and a half.
I have heard.
The mitzvah is to try.
Yeah.
That's the difference. The distinction is that you're not held accountable with this mitzvah for results. Why? Because the results are out of your control. It's not like put on tefillin. So how I mean, you put on tefillin. The mitzvah here is it's out of a person's control.
Yeah.
You can do what you can. You can't control the outcome of this mitzvah.
Right.
So you're not held for that.
Well, why did I hear somewhere that the mitzvah is four also?
No, I've never seen that. I've just seen the one on the one.
Did you have a chance
to replace the parents? Yes. I what I saw, I asked the question, the answer that I got is that many do allow it. I asked what's the rationale behind it, because it seems to be that it's not a pre-embryo anymore, it's now in the woman, it's now in the womb, it's not being carried. So it would seem very problematic. It would seem like...
Those of you who don't know, this is like if you get implanted with four and they all take...
So I think the allowance is obviously if it's a danger to either the others or to the mother. I think once you bring in the danger factor, even if it's emotionally dangerous, psychologically, there's different forms of danger. This is really more of a question regarding like the issue of abortion and when that's, you know, what does halacha say about that? But in general, if there's danger present, then a threat. Then there's something to talk about as far as options.
But if there's not like one sick twin and one healthy twin, and if it's just four evenly, you know,
if the doctor conclusively say there's no risk to the mother and
more risk after two,
right?
Always, right.
But I mean, selective reduction is just removing randomly two out of the four.
Right. I'm saying if there's a medical basis for it, then there may be a halachic allowance. Again, every case would have to be, the particulars of what's going on, medical history, all that stuff. But again, I asked the question. The response was, it may be allowed. I asked back, well, what are the considerations? What are the factors specifically? I haven't received an answer yet. So I'm waiting on the specific factors involved with that. But it seems like it's not a cut and dry. It's not shut door. You can never reduce. You can never. It seems like there's a possibility.